Today's Taisho will be on case 45 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 45 is entitled Hoen's Who Is He? Hoen of Tozon said, "Even Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he?" Mumon's comment, "If you can really see this another with perfect clarity, it is like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not?" Mumon's verse, "Don't draw another's bow. Don't ride another's horse. Don't discuss another's faults. Don't explore another's affairs." I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning and sitting so well, both online and here. We really do the work, right? We really sit. And when we're sitting, we're working through our obstacles. And long sitting is the way to do that, right? I mean, when you sit for 20 minutes, you begin to enter a state of relaxation after about 15 minutes. And after that, if you sit for another 10 or 15 minutes, you're beginning to meditate. You're beginning to drop down through the layers of the mind. And if you persist, you'll go through many different mental states, eventually entering empty mind. And from Ushin, or empty mind, we do a lot of the work of clearing away our mental habits, our obstructive mental habits, as they're called. So, you know, the more time you spend in that state beyond the relaxation state, the more time you spend in that period after the first 15 minutes, the more of the work, the crucial work you're doing. If you meet people who say that they meditate for 15 or 20 minutes a day, they should be applauded, you know, please, by all means. But please understand that really meditation starts after about 15 or 20 minutes. That's where we begin to do the work. And when we begin to do the work that we've been doing today, where we sit, you know, like for an hour and a half, it's a challenge, right? You have to really, you know, breathe deeply when you sit down on the cushion, and you really have to concentrate. But, you know, that kind of sustained deep sitting is liberatory. That really sets us free. You know, my second teacher, Webb Roshi, was in China once, and if you look at Chinese temples, on the entryway to the temple, there's often like a placard. It's like a piece of wood in a frame, and there are some characters in the frame, right? They've been carved into wood. And the carving on this temple was the characters were basically deep sitting, not crude spirited. It was like they were deep sitting, not crude spirited, not crude spirited. And basically, deep sitting makes people not crude spirited. So this kind of sustained practice is, it sets us free. Every time we sit down on the cushion, we're working through our illusions. You know, I should say that this is a little different from the practice of many people in the United States today. You know, recently I met somebody who had been meditating for a long time, like 15 years. And I asked this person, what do you do when you meditate? And the person said, I watch my breath. And I basically said, and then what? And the person said, that's it. I was really surprised that the person was just practicing what I think of as a very preliminary practice, watching the breath until you can enter samadhi. But the more I thought about it, I imagine that that's actually rather common in the United States today. Many people use meditation as a way of adapting to ordinary life. And by the way, that's a wonderful thing. I'm so glad meditation is available to you to, you know, deal with ordinary life. So you know, when I was in graduate school and I started meditating, it was so helpful. I would be very stressed after going to my classes, and I would sit down, and after about 15 or 20 minutes, I would feel much better. You know, I would feel really much better. It was like the stress was gone, this sense of well-being was there, and you know, if I hadn't run into Genki Roshi, if I hadn't run into Takabayashi Genki Roshi, that might have been my meditation practice, you know, for the rest of my life, and it worked for me, right? It got rid of the stress. I felt better. And I think millions of Americans practice meditation that way. It's like it's medicine for the short term, right? So if you have to clean the bathroom, cleaning the bathroom is one of my jobs. I don't enjoy it. It takes forever to clean the bathroom, at least at my house. And it could take half a day, I'm not kidding, to get that bathroom clean. So, you know, if I think of it as a practice, if I think, you know, this is like practice, I'm going to get this bathroom clean. When I clean the bathroom, you know, I'm going to breathe as I have a little toothbrush that I use to, you know, get the grout between the tiles. And if I breathe into that, you know, it does make the task a little easier, you know. So I'm turning cleaning the bathroom into a practice. And this is not unheard of in the Buddhist world. You know, actually there are sanghas in Japan, monastic sanghas, that actually clean. That's one of their practices. So they not only clean their own temple, they clean people's house. They'll clean the houses of people who are too ill to clean their own houses, which I think is a wonderful, generous practice. You know, so if somebody in the community can't clean her house because she's sick or his house, they'll come over and clean the heck out of it, you know, and leave it spotless. And that's really bodhisattva work, right? And, you know, when they clean with this bodhisattva mind of getting the, you know, get the black mold out from between the grout, you know, make sure the sink shines, you know, all the knobs on the shower, if you can, you know, hit that with some white vinegar, you know, they shine like stars, you know. So that there's a kind of wisdom to practicing just to get by in your everyday life, right? I think that's a good thing. I'm so glad people have that practice. But on the other hand, there's a real limitation to that understanding of what we're doing. I think it's almost kind of tragic that so many people today practice in a spirit of just trying to deal with their immediate needs. And we all have these immediate needs that are very pressing. So, you know, I too sometimes just sit down on the cushion just to peel myself off the ceiling because something, you know, very challenging has happened. And I too watch my breath until I get to a place where I can be calm and I can deal with the problem. So you know, there's a spirit of practice which sees meditation practice, sees what we're doing as like a tool for life, tool for living. And you know, we have other tools for living. We have our our education. You know, jogging is a tool for living. If you lift weights, that's a tool for living. You know, swimming. If all of these are, like, you could say, tools for living. So meditation becomes like a tool in the toolbox. Yeah. And I encounter people pretty frequently who practice meditation in that spirit. But I'd like to say that if you practice that way, please keep it up. But at some point, you might begin to feel that your practice is not repaying the effort you're putting into it. You know, this person I spoke to recently had been practicing breath perception meditation intensely for a certain amount of time, and then had his practice had just trailed off and had become very intermittent. And one of the reasons the person reached out to me was because he was thinking about more seriously practicing again. But when the person described his practice to me, it's just like, I just watch my breath until the person didn't say samadhi, but basically until I get calm and I go into samadhi. It didn't surprise me that the person had stopped practicing, and I'm not criticizing. You know, the practice worked in a way. You could get this person to a place of calm and stability, but you know, that was as far as it had taken him. You know, I read this article maybe 5 years ago. It made the rounds in psychology. You know, I have friends who are psychologists or psychotherapists, and one of my psychotherapist friends sent me this article, and it was about long-term, and again, I'm not criticizing anybody, it's long-term mindfulness practitioners. And these are people who have been doing mindfulness meditation for like 20 years. And it said a certain number of these people actually had struggles with depression. You know, when I read the article, that was really interesting because I can understand that. You know, I think they're practicing to get to a place that's calm and stable, that's grounded, that samadhi state, but maybe the way they're practicing isn't going deeper into the deeper layers of the mind, right? So it's one thing to get rid of your anxiety. See, that's a wonderful thing. So if you can sit down on the cushion and you can get rid of your anxiety, great. But that's not the same thing as understanding or having insight into the sources of your anxiety. See, it's like you have an illness and you can treat the symptoms, you know, but you're not getting to the underlying problem. And it seems to me that you could practice meditation that way too. If meditation is just another tool in the toolbox to help you cope with life, you know, I'm not entirely convinced that is a good thing in the long term, because there are so many unacknowledged obstacles that we carry around with us, or unacknowledged energy habits that are destructive. Why are we so nervous sometimes? Why are we so fearful sometimes, right? And you know, if you do meditation, one of the in this way, this sort of sustained, deeper meditation, you know, we begin to encounter the sources of our fear, the sources of our anxiety, the sources of our anger, and so on. We work through and dissolve them, right? And this is really a different way of approaching things, right? You know, in other words, you know, there's a very famous book that was a New York Times bestseller. And it's called After the Enlightenment, The Laundry. And this author is a wonderful writer, very entertaining and thoughtful. But basically the argument is, you know, we should practice meditation because it helps us in our everyday life. And this person's, you know, title says it all in a way, right? It's like, after meditation, we do the laundry. That's what meditation is all about, doing the laundry better, right? Or living our life, doing our laundry, taking the kids to the sporting event. And I think there's some truth to that. But I'd like to turn it around and put it in a rather different way. I'd like to say, the reason we do the laundry is so that we can pursue enlightenment, you know? The reason we, in other words, the purpose of our lives is to wake up. That, in my opinion, that's the truth. You know, the purpose of life is to discover who we really are, what we really are. And the Buddhist view is that we are not really even human beings, even though we think we're human beings. Our fundamental nature is Buddha nature. Our fundamental nature is enlightenment. We say enlightened mind, Buddha nature, the Dharmakaya, all of these. So you know, I think we forget our fundamental nature if we're practicing meditation just to cope with our everyday lives. See, I'm not criticizing doing that. It's so wonderful for people to, if you're drowning and somebody throws you a life preserver, please grab the life preserver, right? But why are you drowning, right? You know, you're drowning because you have misunderstood the nature of your life or the nature of yourself. So if practice is just like a tool in the toolbox, it's just like a Band-Aid, or it's like some mercuricone you put on when you cut your hand, it does the job, right? But there's such a bigger life available to you if you practice in a different spirit. Now, I'm certainly not saying that everybody who practices has to enter a monastery. You know, please sell your home, say goodbye to your wife and kids, or your husband and your kids, and go to a monastery. I'm not saying that. You know, even in monastic situations, somebody has to, you know, make the dinner. You know, somebody has to clean the place. But I do think there's this issue of priorities, right? There's this issue of priorities. I think that our great challenge in this world is to discover who we really are, what we really are. And I think that much of our suffering comes from confusion about that, right? Confusion. You know, this koan is going right to the heart of it, right? Hoen of Tozan said, even Shakyamuni, that is, even the historical Buddha Siddhartha Gautama, even Shakya and Maitreya, the future Buddha, are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he? See. This is like going right to the heart of it, right? It's asking you, you know, what ultimately does it mean to be alive? What is this all about, right? And I think the koan is asking all of us to sit on the cushion and say, you know, who am I really? Who am I really? And it's, you know, I can say, well, I'm Kurt, you know, I'm Kurt. And, you know, when Kurt gets stressed, he sits down on the cushion and he meditates and he gets calm. And that's a plus, right? I will be a better person, a better teacher. I'll be better in my workplace. It's very important to do your job wholeheartedly and with concern for others. So, you know, when I'm a teacher, you know, sometimes I have the most wonderful students, but if you're a teacher, every once in a while you'll have some kid in the class who is a pain in the ass, right? Who just does, who, you know, doesn't let the lecture go or the lesson unfold, gives you a hard time, is working out some, acting out in class, you know. And that's when you really need to just, you know, breathe deeply, exercise, you know, practice loving kindness. You know, don't strangle this person, you'll go to jail, but you don't want to do it, even if you wouldn't go to jail, because that's not, you know, that's not what the Buddha would do. So, you know, we use our practice to cope with that situation. That's wonderful, right? And so I'm not knocking that, but I'm just saying there's a danger if that's the limit of our practice, if that's the boundary we've set for our practice, you know, we're not really understanding who that student is or who we are, right? And, you know, and so, you know, one way to practice is this idea of Zen as, you know, meditation as tool in the toolbox. But the other way is to practice for enlightenment, right? Is practicing to achieve enlightenment. And lots of people in the United States don't believe in enlightenment. They practice, there's a whole movement in American Buddhism called, and if you consider yourself a secular Buddhist, that's okay. I'm, again, not stepping, trying to step on anybody's toes. But if you say, well, I practice Buddhism, but I don't believe in enlightenment, it's like, well, why do you call that Buddhism, right? Why would that be Buddhism again? You know, so I mean, when the Buddha discovered, you know, the Buddha became, Buddha, according to Buddhist teaching, was the son of a prince, probably not really. He was actually he was the son of the Speaker of the Parliament in the Shakya Republic. So his father was a political leader in a democratic republic in northeastern India called the Shakya Republic. And he had probably marked out for his son a career in politics as a leader of his community. The Shakyas were like a clan or a people in what later became Magadha, at the foothills of the Himalayas. And it, you know, according to the sutras, he became aware of, it began to really bother him that everything he cared about was going to disappear. According to the teaching, you know, he saw a person who was sick, he saw a corpse, he saw a person who was old, you know, God forbid, somebody who's old, oh my gosh. So anyway, you know, this rocked him. I doubt it really worked like that, but he became aware, right, that we live in a kind of collective dream. We live in a kind of collective dream. And, you know, we waste a lot of energy and hatred and anger on things that aren't real. And so, you know, he had just gotten married, he had a little child, and he was so disturbed by these questions that he actually left. He didn't leave them on the street, he left them in this nice situation. But he set off on this quest, trying to, what's it all about, right? And he studied with two of the leading teachers of his time, they were the foremost, most advanced, you could say, meditation practitioners of the time. And one of them taught him how to go into samadhi, which was a new discovery in meditation practice at the time. And the other person taught him how to enter emptiness. And the sutras say that in both cases he became very adept, but he wasn't satisfied. You know, once he learned how to enter samadhi, you know, he could have gone back. He could have, okay, I know how to get calm when I'm stressed. I'll go back to the king, you know, to the palace, and I'll resume my responsibilities. But he didn't do that. And when he learned about emptiness, he realized that, you know, all of these people were practicing emptiness, but they weren't really using it to liberate themselves from their illusions and encounter the mind root, the luminous mind, which he hadn't discovered yet, but he was dissatisfied with the practice. These people thought that once you've reached emptiness, you had achieved liberation. You had now freed yourself from all karma. So the Buddha left them, and he went, continued to practice on his own. And we're told that he had his great awakening experience. He realized that basically the way we understand most things is not true. You know, and he's of course correct, I would say. You know, we all are prejudiced in favor of the reality we grow up in, right? So most people believe that they live in reality. More or less, we live in reality. But, you know, the Buddhist view is that we live in unreality most of the time. And we work very hard to ignore that until things happen that are inescapably, like, contradictory. And even the contradictions don't, like, arouse us from our collective dream. You know, so the most obvious example right now is, you know, actually last year we produced more CO2 than ever. You know, it's like, wait a minute, I thought we were making progress on the environmental front. But, you know, on the one hand, we know we can't go on like this. But on the other hand, we're producing more CO2 than ever. And every once in a while, we get a little glimpse of just how unreal our values are and our ways of thinking are. We see a little crack in the contradiction. But you know, the Buddha said that basically much of what we assume about the world is incorrect, right? You know, in the West, in Christianity, there's this idea of original sin. People are sinful. You know, they do bad things. And, you know, the assumption there is that they know what's good, but they choose the bad, right? That's a Western religious way of thinking about things. So people know what's good, but they choose the bad, and then they think, why did I choose the bad, right? The Buddhist view is rather different. It's that people do what they think is good, but they're so deluded by their assumptions that even when they're trying to do a good thing, they wind up doing terrible things. Right. Yeah. So the Buddhist view is that much of what we take for granted is an illusion, and we often act from our illusions with very good intentions. But unfortunately, they have bad results because we're not seeing things as they really are. So the Buddhist view is that if you just practice for, you could say, the toolkit idea, you know, you're not really freeing yourself from your own personal illusions, or from a lot of the illusions that make up the fabric of our life, you know. And it's very hard to see through those illusions unless we work very, you know, we do the work that we've been doing here on the cushion today. You know, I was actually raised in a military family. My father is from New Jersey, and he joined the Navy and served in the Pacific. And when he came out, he became a naval officer, and then he later worked for the Department of Defense. And you know, my father, for my father, the United States was just this shining beacon of democracy in the world. And you know, I remember I was young. I was about maybe 16 when I was about. I had to register for the draft when I was 16. And I had a draft number. I never got called up because I was in college. But my father actually served in Vietnam. He served what are called tours of duty. He was in Vietnam for two tours of duty. And you know, basically, he was involved with naval operations in Vietnam. And you know, I would come home from college, you know, I was very much taken with the anti-war movement. And I would come home and we would have these terrible arguments, right? And, you know, my father, you know, he just deeply believed that the United States was like a beacon of freedom and democracy. And I remember trying to get him to read this book, book by this woman, Frances Fitzgerald. She wrote this book on Vietnam it was a wonderful book. I think it's Fire in the Lake, I think it's called. And, you know, it was all about Vietnamese history and French colonization. And it's like he wouldn't open, you know, my father had an education. You know, he wasn't, he just existentially he just couldn't do it. It was just like too far. It was a bridge too far for him. And you know, I think he going to Vietnam was a very difficult experience for him. I think he had to really not see a lot. He had to repress a lot in Vietnam in order to maintain this image of himself and his country as this benevolent and, you know, wonderful force in the world. The arguments would sometimes become quite bitter. You know, my father, he would yell at me. It was unthinkable, you know. We were the country that had defeated Hitler. We were, you know, and so on. And you know, I was a kid, I didn't know how to cope with this, so I just tried to throw more evidence at my father. And that only made things worse. You know, and I mean, we all have a person like my father inside of us. It's just, it took me a long time to realize that. You know, I'm more like my father than I thought. You know, we all have a person inside of us who is terrified of seeing things as they really are, because, you know, so much of our emotional and our investments are in a certain way of looking at the world. And you know, just to give you another example of this, my grandparents were like, they were very far to the left. You know, they were like communists, you know, basically. So, you know, they deeply believed this was going to all work out, you know, long after Stalin turned out to be a really terrible person. And you know, it was very hard for them to open their eyes and say, oh, you know, actually Stalinism is a really bad thing. And you know, my father just thought his parents were horrible people, and I for a while thought my father was a horrible person. But you know, I think my Zen practice has helped me to see how deeply we have these investments in fantasies and half-truths and illusions. And you know, if we stop with feeling better sometimes, we're not really solving the problem. And I think that's true for societies, right? You know, it's also true for people. You know, it took me a long time to see to see how much I was like my father, how I had my own I have many of the same fears and anxieties as my father, many of the same mental habits, and Zen helped me to see those. And, you know, we could have just agreed to disagree. We could have gotten together once in a while and gone to a movie or had dinner or something. But that really wouldn't be insight. That really wouldn't have changed anything, you know. A lot of Zen practice made it possible for me at the end of my father's life to be with him in a very different way, right? You know, I saw him as a suffering person who, you know, had a certain kind of life experience that limited him, and I could see the sources of his fear because I could see the sources of my own fear. You know, that I think was precious and really valuable. You know, so one way to practice Zen is to practice, you know, as a set of answers, right? Zen is a set of answers. Buddhism is a set of answers. So, you know, if Buddhism is a set of tools, you know, mindfulness, samadhi, and it's a set of answers, you know, and you could certainly practice Buddhism that way, you know. So, for a long time, it's not true anymore, but for about 15 years, we had very close relations with a Sri Lankan community here in New Jersey, because a couple of the members were actually also members of our Sangha here. They would practice, you know, South Asian Buddhism in their Sri Lankan community, and then they would do meditation practice over here, and they would invite me to their events and so on. And very few of those people actually meditated. It was pretty amazing to me. They were very deferential towards. They had the priests, you know, who wore orange robes and shaved their heads, and they had special ceremonies where they'd honor the priests. And I was always trying to get them to do meditation, you know, and they really didn't want to do meditation. And when things would happen, they all had like answers up their sleeves, you know. So one of our members was this really wonderful woman named Sharmini Mukherjee. Her husband Pradeep and she were, she was Sri Lankan and he's a Bengali. And they practiced with us many, many years. And then she developed scleroderma, this fatal disease, and died. And when I went to speak at her funeral, I talked about some aspects of Buddhist practice. And people came up to me and they all said, yes, you know, impermanence. It's all impermanence. And it kind of pissed me off, I have to say, because, you know, when somebody dies and you just say, oh, impermanence, you're just using an idea to cover over something. You're putting it in a little box called impermanence. You know, to really engage with death is quite a challenge, right? There's a very famous Zen story about a monk comes to the monastery and finds that second in command is the master, the shifu, has just died. And the monk is shocked to see that his main student is sobbing. It's like, and he says, I thought you were a man of the way. I thought you were enlightened. Why are you crying? And the monk says, listen, when I want to cry, I'm going to cry. In other words, you know, I'm not afraid to be unhappy. If I'm a person who practices Zen, I'm not afraid to be unhappy. You know, I'm not afraid to be happy. I'm not afraid to be unhappy. I'm going to investigate happiness and investigate unhappiness, see? It's not don't be unhappy. Don't be, investigate the sources of your, so look, my Sri Lankan friends appreciate Buddhism as a set of tools and a set of answers. But we Zen people practice Buddhism in a very different spirit, right? We understand our practice as a series of questions. To practice Zen is to live in the question. The question is central. See, the practice of, you know, if you want to be a regular Buddhist, somebody can hand you a book and it'll say, here's the basics of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Seven Factors of Mind, you know, and so on. They can give you, there's all these numbered items that sort of like in the Buddhist catechism sort of thing. But what good would those do you, right? What good? Then if somebody dies, you can just say, ah, impermanence, right? You know, what is death? What is life? What is death? What is the self? What is the self? What is the mind? See, those are not academic questions. That's what, to my understanding, Buddhism is all about. You know, the way we teach Zen is not to give people answers, but to, you know, koans create questions. They point to contradictions in our world. And they say, go into deep mushin and explore this, right? Explore these contradictions, right? And that's the essence of Zen practice, right? Is to, don't, you know, normally we back away from the contradictions, or we try to paper them over with platitudes, like all, you know, everything is impermanent, right? But you know, what Zen wants to do is tear off the Band-Aid and look at the wound, right? Let's tear off the Band-Aid and look at the wound. That's where liberation comes from. So you know, I love this koan because, you know, many people, if they say they're Buddhist, they say, I'm a follower of Shakyamuni, of Siddhartha Gautama, right? Siddhartha Gautama. Or they can say, I'm a follower of Siddhartha Gautama, and I also am anticipating the arrival of the next Buddha of the next world age, Maitreya. But you know, that's not real Buddhism, is it? I mean, to understand the Buddha, you have to go where the Buddha went. You have to go, you know, the Buddha, if you read the Pali Sutras, it's very interesting. You know, the Buddha didn't say, the Buddha did say, first of all, he said, you know, he would talk to farmers and barbers and merchants, and he would say, you know, please practice meditation. Please practice. It will help you. Please apply the ethical principles of my teaching to your life, and it will be a better life. So he didn't say, you know, unless you're a monk, you know, there's no hope for you, or something like that. In fact, you know, if you read the Pali Sutras, there's about 25 people, men and women, who achieved enlightenment who weren't monks, right? Who weren't nuns. But you know, the path to awakening involves, you know, what we did this morning, sitting down on the cushion and investigating, always investigating. So, you know, a person who's been watching, imagine, you know, this person that I talked to the other day, you know, said that he had been practicing breath meditation for 20 years, something like that. And it's like, well, I didn't do this because I didn't want to be aggressive or offensive. But, you know, a real Zen master would have said, well, what is the breath anyway? And the person wouldn't have been able to answer. And then, you know, I didn't want to hurt somebody's feelings, but if I had been totally truthful, I would say, you've been practicing watching the breath for 25 years, but you don't know what the breath is. Don't you see that that's a problem? And if the person went home and said, my God, I don't even know what the breath is, and I've been watching it for 25 years, it's like, ah, now you're on the path. See, now you're on the path to enlightenment. See, I hope I'm making some sense. And of course, to be on the path to enlightenment is to believe that something called enlightenment really exists. And enlightenment means literally seeing through our illusions, which are layered thick and deep, within us and in our world, right, in our culture. Working through our illusions patiently until we see the source of our own awareness, which is Buddha mind. And, you know, I would say please don't settle for anything less than that. You know, life is short, but why live in confusion? Why live in confusion? And why live in deception? You know, the teaching of the Dharma is that you're at the core of your mind is enlightened awareness. You are the Buddha. And we don't feel like the Buddha because we have so many layers of obstruction in the way. But why, you know, why go through life and not at least try to wake up, right? I mean, why would one do that? Hoan of Tozon said, and by the way, when I said, why would one do that? That's a question, right? Investigate, right? Go into samadhi and investigate. Why would one do that? To practice Zen is to live in the question. You know, what is breath? What is the self? What does it mean to be born? What does it mean to die, right? I mean, basically, we have logical answers for those, but that's not how we Zen people investigate. We go into deep mushin, right? And when we begin to ask the question of our deeper mind, you know, all this stuff comes up. You know, people we know who have, you know, come to an unhappy end, people we know who have been afraid all their lives, and we see our own fear. Little by little, all of this begins to open up and clarify. Hoan of Tozon said, even the Lord Buddha and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he? Who? Look. Mulmon's comment, if you can really see this another with perfect clarity, it is like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not? See, Mulmon's verse, don't draw another's bow. Don't ride another's horse. Don't discuss another's faults. Don't explore another's affairs. So much of what we take for granted, you know, we're living out the fantasies of people who lived long before us, right? And we're accepting them as real, and they're totally fantasies. You know, we live in a collective dream. Even the idea of myself is not real, right? So we're always drawing somebody else's bow. We're always dancing to somebody else's tune. We're always, you know, acting out the script somebody else has wrote. He says, stop doing that. Live in the question. Live in the question. And we were living in the question today. Beautiful, beautiful practice.